Holding the Line Against Evil. The sixth talk at Gutenberg College's 2013 Summer Institute, How to Follow Jesus When You Cannot Kill the Beast, was presented by David Crabtree on August 2, 2013. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm talking about holding the line against evil. I picked the topic holding the line against evil, and I picked it because I'm not really taking on anything that Jack said, but in reading his paper, this is the issue that came to mind because it's an issue that is personally very significant. I think about this issue whenever I think about the end of time. There are a number of instances in the New Testament where Jesus wonders whether there will be anyone left with faith at the end of time. And I frequently think about, what does it mean to keep the faith? What does it take? And why would it be that so many would fall away? What's the nature of that problem? So I actually think about this very often, and it's a personal issue for me. And I don't know that I have a great deal of wisdom about it, but I'm going to talk, and then maybe we can talk about it afterwards, and we can share our wisdom, pool our wisdom. The faith that Jesus is talking about when he wonders whether there will be anyone with faith, it has substance to it. It's not just faith, but it has substance to it. It's not Walt Disney faith. I believe in miracles. If you believe hard enough, it'll happen. It's not Walt Disney faith. It's a faith in something very specific, and that is faith in the God who is there, that he is both just and he is righteous, and that he is willing and able to save those who will turn to him, will embrace him. That's the faith that he's talking about. So the faith has content, and if we are willing to turn to the God who is there, who is just and righteous, that means that we have to be people who value what is just and what is righteous, because that's what he values. That's what he is all about. And if that's the case, then we have to know what is good and what is righteous. And that's the issue that I want to talk about, is how do we keep our heads straight with respect to what is good and righteous in an environment in which that is increasingly less important, and in fact, people are increasingly rebellious against it. Now, I could talk about this on two different levels. One would be, how do we take action as a society? How do we act in society to keep it from losing its moorings? On a societal basis, then, how do we hold the line? I think that is a very interesting question and a very important question. I am not going to take it up. I share with Jack, and I can't remember whether I'm pessimistic or optimistic at this point, but I share Jack's perspective that I see no indication that this culture is about to turn with respect to responding to the God who is there. And I think we are all, to one degree or another, economic beings. That is to say, we all ration resources. And in order to ration resources, we have to make judgments as to how those resources could be used best. And just as Jesus sent the disciples out, and if they went to a city that was not initially receptive, go on to the next one. That's rationing resources. And I think that makes all kinds of sense. And the economic consideration is a consideration in making those decisions of rationing resources. And my judgment is things are not looking like they're going to turn around. I don't know that it makes any difference in what I'm going to do in the rest of my life. It may or it may not. But my expectations, and that's what Jack was talking about, my expectations are that things will not turn around. There's another level at which we can talk about holding the line, and that's the one I am going to talk about, and that is, in my individual soul, how do I hold the line? That is, how do I stay firm? How do I embrace that which is good and just and not compromise, not capitulate to the culture? I am extremely sobered by the story of Lot, that Lot chose the well-watered land and he moved down into that land. It happened to be the land in which Sodom and Gomorrah were located. And later we read in the account that he had moved into Sodom. And then we find that angels are sent to rescue him from that city because there aren't, what is it, get down to 10 righteous people in the city. And Lot is rescued. But clearly the culture had a huge impact on his wife and on his daughters. And I'm sobered by that and thinking about what kind of an impact does the culture around us have on us and have on our families, and how do we cope with that? First of all, I'm going to reflect a little bit about my recollections of what has happened over the last 60 years in American culture. Because I think that understanding that is helpful in understanding the situation that we find ourselves in. And I think it's something that many of you can identify with, and those of you who aren't old enough to identify with can hopefully benefit from. In thinking about this, I was sitting down thinking, I want to think about what happened in the past in a way that is completely unvarnished. I want to go down to raw memory of what actually happened without any accretions on it. I don't think that can be done. Certainly not with my memory. I can't get down to bedrock. And I think that the reason for that is over the course of my life, I have remembered what happened in the past, and I have kind of built on that or massaged it over time. And it's hard to distinguish now between the raw memory and my massaging. And I suspect that we all do that in various ways with various issues. We are all revisionist historians, rewriting the past to suit our purposes. So this is the best I can do. This may not be bedrock memory, but it's the best I can do. And others of you went through the same period of time, and maybe we can pool our experiences and reflect on what happened. I grew up in Staten, Oregon. That's where I was born. That's where I lived for the first 7 years of my life. Staten, Oregon had about 2,000 people when we lived there. Not a very large town, just east of Salem. And my recollection of living in that town were overwhelmingly positive, and I couldn't have felt safer. I mean, to the extent that I knew about crime, most of it was outside of Staten. It wasn't in Staten. It's not that there was no crime. I remember, after my sixth birthday, I got a bike for my birthday. And a day or two later, I forgot to put it in the garage, and it was out in the front yard over the night, and it disappeared. So it wasn't crime-free. The other phenomenon that I remember very vividly is every summer, migrant workers would come to Staten, and they would be working in the fields, and all of the shop owners would become much more vigilant. And any crime that happened in the summer, it was blamed on the Okies. They did it. But for the most part, my recollections of my early years were overwhelmingly positive. In fact, I can remember walking from our house, which is probably a half a mile, maybe three-quarters of a mile from downtown, walking from my house by myself downtown and back on numerous occasions. Now, it helped that we were related to probably a third of the people in the city, in the town, and There were a lot of at-home mothers, and I probably was never out of the sight of a relative all the way there and back. But I would walk downtown and to the grocery store, and I would go and get things and bring them to the cashier, and she would ring them up, and I had no money. And she would just write down, the Crabtrees owe more money. The most negative thing I can remember about my experience in those first 7 years is the city was very divided between the Protestants and the Catholics. The Protestants and the Catholics had nothing to do with each other. We shopped in different stores. We went to different churches. We went to different schools. We played with, we didn't mix in when we played. Always seemed rather strange to me, but that was definitely the way it was. In spite of that, however, there was a uniformity of a moral code that every institution, whether it was Catholic or Protestant, every family, every civic institution, the schools, they all reinforced a very similar moral code. And that was the moral code that was built into me as a young child. And that was reinforced everywhere, and it was essentially agreed to by everyone. We moved from there to Klamath Falls, which is that was a very different situation. My father was a district attorney, and he was sent there in part to deal with corruption, and there was a very high crime county. But that did not really touch me. As far as my experience going to school and my friends and my family, it continued to be that kind of safe and homogenous environment. And by homogenous, I mean a morally homogenous environment. Everybody shared a similar moral code. Then in 1964, we moved to Salem. And Salem was a little bit different. Klamath Falls was rural and conservative. Salem, I would not call it liberal. I mean, it wasn't like Eugene or Portland, but it was more liberal than was Klamath Falls. And I remember that first year that we were in Salem, it was 64, things changed. And it was like, I was describing this to Tim yesterday, it was like the windows were opened and a different wind blew in. And as I was trying to remember, what was the first thing I picked up on that had changed? There was a boy in our class, and he was in the sixth grade, and he decided to grow his hair out, and he grew it to the place where the hair touched the collar of his shirt. And that was against the dress code. We had dress codes. And that caused a big ruckus. And the question, the administration, on the one hand, didn't want to act, but on the other hand, from their perspective, he was forcing their hand. He had violated the dress code and something had to be done. That was the first incident that I observed. And what was interesting is it was followed by one after another of those same kinds of challenges, especially on the dress code, by different people. And that it continued into the seventh grade, which was then moving to junior high school, seventh grade, eighth grade, and ninth grade. That process didn't just continue, but it accelerated. It was a time in which it seemed to be good and right to challenge authority, to challenge that which was traditionally established. Why? Why should we be doing these things? And those challenges came constantly. And it was kind of instilled in us that we were the generation that was going to change things. We were going to change things for the better. That by challenging all those ridiculous rules and traditions, we were going to bring about changes in society that would be far-reaching and that would be very beneficial. That process continued with students becoming more and more free to experiment and to test boundaries and to do things that were considered to be wrong. And I watched my classmates change before my eyes and become involved primarily in drugs. There wasn't a lot of alcohol. It was mostly drugs. It was mostly hallucinogenics, LSD, and then speed and some pot. But this was in junior high. It started in junior high, and then high school. Absolutely. In fact, in high school, it became common. One of the strange things I observed about the society in junior high and then high school is. In grade school and in the first year of junior high, there were the kind of, well, the hoods, the ones who were on the outs socially. And if anybody was going to do drugs or drink, it was them. And I remember when we went to high school, all of a sudden, the most popular kids were hanging out with the hoods. And I thought, what's going on here? This is very strange. And it became clear later what was happening. The hoods knew where the drugs were. And they were the ones who were getting and providing them to the popular kids. And there developed this pattern in our high school where there was a group of about 20 guys, and they were of the most popular of the guys. On Fridays at lunchtime, they would all get lunch passes. And say they were going home for lunch. Well, they did go to somebody's home for lunch. And instead of eating lunch, they would sit around and take drugs. And then after lunch, some of them would come back to school. Others were not capable. And it was kind of a big deal because they were coming back to school and they were high. And everybody knew they were high. But they wanted to be seen. And it really made drugs the thing to do. And I don't know the figures. I couldn't tell you how many, but my perception would be that it must have been between a fourth and a third of my classmates would have done drugs before they were done with high school. And some of them doing them very regularly. And it was all part of this thing that we're doing something new and different. And we're challenging the norms. We're opening up our minds, even if it's chemically. And we're going to look at the world differently, and we are going to solve the problems that the previous generations not only were too dumb to solve, but they were so dumb they created them. And now we're seeing the legacy of that. The 60s revolution, I think, was a revolution. And it was a revolution like most revolutions. They are really good at deconstructing. They are really bad at reconstructing. That what we're doing is we're living in the rubble of what was created in the 60s. There was nothing created in its place. We're just living in rubble. And I think that helps to understand what Jack was talking about, is this view that has come to dominate that is incoherent. And part of that incoherency is coming from the fact that we're just living in rubble. And the incoherency has come to be philosophically supported. And what we're seeing is a society in which the traditional life that came under assault in the 60s was seen as being at base Christianity. Christianity was right at the heart of that culture. And as a result, as we dismember this thing, Christianity has to be in our sights. That has to be part of our target. It has to be eradicated and its influence eradicated. And I think that's the origin of the contrabiblicism that Jack is talking about. The result of that is that we live in a culture that is incredibly unstable and ungrounded. I remember Marx's phrase with respect to the transition that culture went through as a result of the Industrial Revolution and going from an agrarian society to an industrialized society. He says, everything that was solid melted into air. And I feel like that's what's happened as a result of the 60s. Everything that was solid has melted into the air. And as a result, we live in a society now where our children, my children, are growing up in an environment that is infinitely less stable than the one that I grew up in. I would not argue that the 50s were heaven on earth. That's far from the case. All I'm arguing is that there was a stability there, and there was a shared moral code that was at least reminiscent of the Judeo-Christian moral code, but that's gone now. And now we live in a roll-your-own period of time, where it's roll-your-own everything. It's roll-your-own marriage relationships. It's roll-your-own gender identity. It's roll-your-own morality. It's roll-your-own everything. And that is not only confusing, it is absolutely overwhelming. And I think that helps understand how we've gotten where we are. I think it also helps us to understand why older people are responding to what is happening now differently than younger people are responding to it. Insofar as, if you're as old as I am, you know that things can be different. You know that there can be a more stable kind of environment. I'll just use one example, and that is the number of divorces. When I was in grade school, I can't remember more than one or two friends that I had whose parents were divorced. It was unusual. It became more common as I got older, but at that time it was unusual. Now divorce is extremely common. And my wife's parents got divorced when she was 12 years old. And we've been married now for almost 32 years. And it is still a struggle for her to come to terms with what happened when her father left them. That the legacy of that is enormous. And I don't carry that burden. And it's, in some ways, it's even hard for me to identify with it. Well, now we have a society in which that's the norm rather than the exception. And that's got to have an impact. As we're thinking about what is right and what is wrong and how are we influenced by the culture that's around us, there is no question but what it has a huge impact on us. It has a huge impact on all of us. And on our children, even as one is young, I think it has an even greater impact. And I think about that with my children. And as we're in a culture that has lost its moorings, cares less and less about what is right and wrong, that we are under challenge constantly, that our values become questioned and challenged at every turn. And from my perspective, I think that's both good and bad. On the one hand, it's good in the sense that it does cause us to reflect on what we believe and why we believe it, and is it justified? It's bad in the sense that it is difficult psychologically, emotionally, to deal with all of those challenges all the time, and they kind of wear you down. I want to illustrate this issue with just talking about how my thinking about homosexuality has changed over the last, I better make it 59 years, because I didn't think about it when I was one. but how my thinking has changed on that issue, and it has changed dramatically. And I have thought about it. I think it's certainly instructive to me, and it might be good for all of us to think about. I do identify with Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. If you remember that musical, Tevye, a Jewish man in the Ukraine, who's wanting to hold to tradition. That's what he was taught. That's what he wants to maintain it. He's got three daughters, and each daughter does something that breaks with tradition. The first one, I think, marries someone other than the one that the matchmaker picked out. And he has to come to terms with that. And, you know, the tradition and the tradition. And, you know. I would do the dance, but I don't dance. The second one wants to marry, I think, a secularized Jew. And so, again, that's a little bit further. And Tevye is going, oh, what do I do here? What do I do here? Then the third one wants to marry a Gentile. And once again, I really identify with that and resonate with it, that each step is difficult and you go, is this right or is this not right? Is this step justified or is it not? And those are agonizing decisions. With respect to homosexuality, when I was young, my perspective was, and I don't know where I got it actually, whether it was from my family, from church, or exactly where it came from, it was probably a conglomeration of all of them, was that homosexuality was the worst possible sin, and that homosexuals were of a different order. That is, they were more monster than human. That there was something really wrong and pernicious about them as individuals. That's certainly the way I looked at it. I don't know anybody would have expressed it that way, but that's really the way that I looked at it. So as homosexuality became more common and I started running into real live homosexuals, and it's even friends and relatives who come out of the closet and they're homosexuals. And I'm looking at them and it just does not seem to be the case that they are not human beings, that they are just monsters. And so there was a long process of thinking that through, and what do I do with that? And I came to the conclusion that could not be the case, that they aren't a different order of human being. They are still people who are deserving of my respect and my charity. But is it wrong? And the problem was, if its wrongness was based on their otherness, and they aren't other, then is it wrong? And what I slowly came to terms with is it's wrong, but it's wrong on a different basis. It's not because it's the most pernicious evil that exists. It's not because they are not fully human beings, but it's because it is an obvious violation of the natural order. It's a confusion about the natural order, and that we are called, I think, to be students of the natural order. We are called to have the respect for the natural order that Charlie was talking about, that it gives us awe and wonder because we're students of it. We want to figure it out. We want to appreciate it for what it is, and we want to understand what it tells us about the creator who made it. And we have become such an artificial culture. We are so divorced from the natural order that we don't care. The natural order is no big deal to us. It's not all that interesting. We certainly aren't students of it. And as a result, I think it's easy for us to be confused about the natural order and its value. It is less this way than it was in the 60s, but I remember being bombarded with messages that we as human beings are going to improve on nature. And I suspect that only one who is divorced from nature could reach that conclusion. But we are divorced from culture, from nature, and I think that the argument that something is wrong because it violates the natural order kind of falls on deaf ears for us. And yet, I think that's the basis for it. My perspective now would be that homosexuals are not human beings of a different order. They are people like the rest of us, worthy of respect. It is not the worst sin. It is just another sin, but a sign of confusion about the natural order. And I think that homosexual desires, I've thought a lot about this, and I'm not entirely convinced of this and satisfied with this perspective, but I think that the only way to look at this is that homosexual desires are analogous to adulterous desires. That is to say, we all have impulses to do things that are not right, adultery being one of those. I think we all have experienced adulterous desires or something like that, some kind of temptation like that. And my job as a Christian is to stand over that and say, if there is a desire there, but it's wrong, and I ought not pursue that. And so I think that that's what people with homosexual desires are called to. It is a big step forward to move from having a homosexual impulse to committing a homosexual act, just as it is a big step moving from having an adulterous impulse and moving to an adulterous act. It's taking it to a whole new level of I want to do what I want to do. Okay. But how do I relate to homosexuals? And that has been one of the biggest issues for me. If they are humans of a different kind, they are monsters and they are a pernicious influence, it makes sense to isolate and shun. But as I thought about that, there are lots of other sins that other people commit. If we are going to isolate and shun for every sin that's committed, we are going to be all by ourselves. That there is a lot of tolerance and forbearance that is required of us, just as God is forbearing and patient with respect to us. So I have modified my thinking because much earlier I would have been in favor of the isolation and shunning type approach to homosexuals. But I don't think that's right. I think that it is important for us to maintain relations. However, I think that it is good and proper that I stand my ground with respect to whether it is good in God's eyes, good and proper in God's eyes, or is not. And I have taken the stance that in my relationship with homosexuals, I will not hide, I will not try to in any way disguise the fact that I think that it is wrong, but that it does not impinge upon the fact that I want to relate to them as fellow human beings and fellow sinners who stand in need of God's grace. But I stand with Tevye. Tradition or change? tradition or change. And I think that the change in our culture has actually aided me in clarifying some things with respect to homosexuality that needed to be clarified in my mind. But I fear going too far. I fear making concessions that aren't warranted. And I have a murky mind. It is sometimes hard for me to tell the difference between sound reason and loud cultural voices. And I know that, and that's what makes me particularly cautious. I was going to switch and do a different example of what we're talking about here, but I think I won't. I'm just going to talk about it in general terms. Another area in which I find this problem, one that plagues me, is actually with respect to Gutenberg College. And that is, when there are myriads of decisions that have to be made here, and in 99% of the cases, there is no clear evil and good. It's a decision that has to be made, and it is not obvious that one of those would be an evil choice. So they're difficult choices, and they're constant. But what happens is you make those little choices, and the cumulative effect downstream of 100 different choices is you can end up someplace where you didn't want to be. In fact, you can end up someplace where the priorities, the values for which you stand, have been compromised. And that happens because, first of all, it's hard to make those choices. It's hard to know where those choices are going to lead, what are going to be the implications of that downstream. Furthermore, there are all kinds of pressures that come into bear from a lot of different people. And those people are like me, and that is, to a certain extent, ignorant, and to a certain extent, wicked. And when you get a lot of people all making their contribution, and those are people who have wickedness and ignorance as part of their makeup, those decisions can go lots of different ways. And Earl, in his paper yesterday, was painting the church in a very negative light. From my perspective, the reason that happens is because of the beast in all of us are all contributing to those decisions in one way or another. And as a result, those little nuances to the decisions end up taking it one way or another. I think that is inevitable. That will happen with any organization. I don't think that people can be so clear-headed that every decision is headed 100% in the right direction. The critical thing is not that every decision be made 100% correctly, because I don't think that can be done, but that when you get 150 decisions down the line and somebody says, is that taking us where we want to go? Is that taking us in a direction that's consistent with our values and priorities? And I don't just mean our values and priorities, but God's values and priorities. And if they aren't, then you have to say, we're changing course here. We're going to do something a little different. And I think that's the test of a good organization, is not getting every decision right, but when it becomes apparent that things are drifting in the wrong direction, you reevaluate and come back. That's difficult to do, and churches are like any other organization. The influences and the cultural influences are huge. And even though people are not aware of it, that's what's happening. And as we're in a culture that's less concerned about what is truly good and right, we are surrounded by voices that are more and more confused, and it's harder to find your way. I have three suggestions, and these are suggestions for me as well as you. These are the things that come to mind as things that can help us with respect to holding the line against evil. The first is we need to become culturally aware. That is to say, we need to understand what kind of an impact the culture is having on us, and at what level and at what issues. What are we just absorbing from the culture and therefore seems right and good? And what have we actually sorted out and know to be right and good? And along those lines, it really helps to get yourself out of our particular time and culture, whether that's reading books outside of our time and culture or whether that's going someplace else. But there's nothing like experiencing life and seeing it through the eyes of a different culture to begin to shed light on what you have adopted, which is purely adopted from your culture. The second thing, I am more convinced of the importance of this than I ever have been, and that is our need to know the Bible. And I'm going to add, we need to know the Bible in a particular kind of way, and it's the way that I am going to advocate that we need to know the Bible is one that seems crazy to most people in Christian culture today. And that is, we ought not look at it as a moral code that we are supposed to get down. That application is not the most important thing that we derive from the Bible. In fact, it ought not be our goal in studying the Bible, because application is a complicated thing. As I've said and argued elsewhere, you can't apply a verse. Most people think that you go through and you find these verses and you can kind of cut them out and you paste them together and you've got a moral code that the Bible is advocating. It cannot be done that way. It cannot be done that way. In fact, I think that would be misleading. The way that it works is like a child and a parent. A parent tries to instill an understanding of right and wrong behavior in the child. And a lot of that information is that the parent says, don't do this and do that and don't do this. Well, that's all helpful information. But that's going to change over time. What I told my children specifically not to do when they were 2 years old, when they were 12, I wanted them to do. Don't touch the wood stove when they're 2. When they're 12, load the wood stove. It changes over time because the circumstances have changed. What stayed the same is the values of the parent. And it's the values and the worldview of the parent that gives rise to the commands. And the child has to work back and put together the commands and reconstruct the model of the way that the parent sees the world. And that's critical because it's only a worldview that can be applied. Commands cannot. Because apart, divorced from a worldview, you don't know what the command means and when it's supposed to be acted upon and when it's not supposed to be acted upon. We need to study the Bible, but we need to study the Bible in order to understand who God is and what he's doing in history. That's the really critical thing. And to the extent that we understand that, then we can act on it. We've got something now we can act on and do so intelligently. And the third thing is pray. And I think the pray that we need to pray is a very, very simple one. Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief. That as we make our way through life, especially in dealing with this issue that I'm talking about, trying to hold the line personally with respect to what is right and what is wrong. That is a treacherous course. It is so treacherous that we can't do it. And it is so treacherous that we need to depend heavily on God for Him to guide us through that process. As we face every decision, I think that it has two aspects to it. On the one hand, that decision is infinitely important. It's important for your soul. It's important for the souls around you. But on the other hand, it's absolutely trivial because God's in control of your process. That both are true. It is both infinitely important, and therefore you need to take it seriously. But on the other hand, the weight is off your shoulders because God's in charge of the process. And we need to be able to trust God to bring us through that process. Faith is important in every aspect of our life, not the least of which is helping us to find our way through this morass, this moral morass that we are immersed in. I'm convinced that if we appeal to God for His help and guidance, that He will grant it to us. And we need to come to Him humbly, often, and ask for that guidance. We need it desperately, and He's the only source for that. And I'm confident that He will provide that and guide us through. I'm also quite certain that as we go through this life, it will be messy. We are going to make lots of mistakes in spite of God's guidance. That all is part of the process. That's all part of what God is doing. It won't look pretty, but I am confident that God will see us through it. Those are my comments. Questions, comments?
Thank you, David. I have a question that relates to holding the line and what that looks like. I work for the city of Eugene, which means I work with a lot of homosexuals. Yeah. Most of us, I think, associate homosexuality with promiscuity, kind of a many partners type of idea. There are, however, some homosexuals who want to enter into a committed and what they feel to be a permanent relationship. What should the biblical view of that be? I mean, in any other realm, we would consider a committed sexual relationship to be preferable to a promiscuous, uncommitted one. But this is a different realm. And it's an honest question. I'm not sure what the right answer is.
And your question is,
what should the Christian viewpoint be of a society which is increasingly moving in the direction of accepting and even possibly promoting long-term committed homosexual relationships? There are implications for health care, insurance, all sorts of other issues that most of us just take for granted.
I think that homosexuality is wrong, whether it is promiscuous or whether it is a committed relationship. There is something more noble about a committed relationship, I think. But I think it is wrong, and it is contrary to the natural order. Now it kind of shifts into that other question, and that is, as a society, how do we hold the line? And that is a very difficult issue. It's not straightforward, because it seems to me that there is the time when there are times when society changes, moral norms change within society, and the laws that were restraining that come under a lot of stress. Now, when is it good and proper to change those laws, and when is it good and proper to continue to stand with those laws? And I think that's a very difficult issue, because if you have a law that is universally ignored, you run the risk of allowing law in general to become less respected in a society. If we had a gazillion laughable laws, law would not be taken seriously. On the other hand, laws can be a bit of a restraint on behavior and even on attitudes. So, when is it good to change those laws, and when is it good to retain those laws as a kind of barrier, a kind of holding back? On this particular issue, at this point, I would be opposed to changing the laws to granting homosexual relationships the kind of status that marriage has. I guess I can't bring myself to break that dam. But I could see how a case could be made for that, and it's not 100% clear to me. So is that your question?
Yes, that's exactly it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you for addressing the issue of homosexuality, too. I was really hoping somebody was going to, so I'm glad you did. You know, I kind of came from the opposite direction you did in my, you know, late teens, early 20s. It was more like, what's the big deal? You know, I thought it was perfectly fine. And as my faith developed, I had to face the fact that it's not right. But I still feel like I have erred on the side of wanting to be loving. So I feel like I've erred on the side of not wanting to alienate people from Christianity, wanting to be loving, feeling sympathetic, you know, but I think it's kind of been at the cost of my own moral courage, and it's just something I've been thinking about a lot. I think because, I don't know if it's probably not just my generation, but I feel like I'm being demanded to approve of gay marriage.
Yes.
And I, you know, obviously I can't, but one of my friends, you know, on Facebook, somebody that I respect intellectually as a, you know, intelligent person, said something like, if you don't support marriage equality, then you're just a bad person. I don't see. I mean, she didn't say that directly to me. It was just kind of a general statement. She was like, I just don't see how you could consider yourself a good person. And it hurts me, you know,
right.
Because I do, I think that people have a view of Christians as hating gay people or just thinking they're terrible. And I don't feel that way. I just feel so much sympathy. And I would just have the utmost respect for the believer who has homosexual impulses and doesn't follow through on them. I think that would be the loneliest life I can think of. Not really a question, but I just wanted to say thank you for addressing that.
But I think it's a huge issue for us all to get that sorted out. And it is, I know from my interactions with homosexuals, that it is very difficult to know where to draw that line between respecting them as human beings and actually condoning the choices that they have made. And when do you bring it up? When do you not bring it up? How do you bring it up? Et cetera, et cetera. Those are horrible choices to have to make. They're extremely difficult. But like with most things, I think the principle's fairly clear. It's in the moment, how do you act on it? That's what's excruciatingly difficult.
I think our society, it's so easy to get that mixed up with just the general sexuality in general, because people say, well, why should homosexuals be celibate when heterosexuals aren't? You know, why is one promiscuity okay and the other not? And I think as single people, it's not just the homosexual, it's where is our sexuality? And I think the church needs to address both of those things. And I think the mainline church has dealt so much with homosexuality that they haven't encouraged maybe single people who are heterosexual, you know. And when it's interesting when you talk about, I mean, just recently I heard something about the homosexuality in the priesthood. Well, to me, I mean, they've vowed celibacy, so what difference does it make? You know, I think we've kind of gotten the two, maybe we've forgotten the one with the other.
Our society's confusion about sexuality is humongous. And that is not just the homosexual community. That is across the board. And I think that it's within the church we are just about as confused as people outside the church. That is one area in which the 60s have really done a number on our brains.
Hi. Is it a Christian's place to tell a non-Christian to live like a Christian?
If the question is...
Like, I'm not saying you have to respect it, but should you tell them, hey, you shouldn't do it, because that's what Christians don't do?
Yeah, I don't see it that way. I'm not called to go out and tell people they should live differently.
Right.
But we are called to stand for the truth. So the question is, to the extent that that comes up anywhere, I should stand for what is true. What they're going to do with it, that's their choice.
Right.
And I don't want to do anything to impinge on that. I mean, that's between them and God, and that's where it should be.
Right.
But to the extent that they call me into that, or those issues come surface, then I need to stand for what is true.
In this country, which I still am amazed as I study our history, every one of the signers of the Constitution and the Declaration were raised under a king. They grew up under a king. King was normal. And yet they voted to not have a king. They gave the people, supposedly, ultimately, the power to rule over themselves through appointed representatives. I mean, it's just an amazing amount of power that was supposed to be in our hands. And so we as believers grow up in this nation where we are told your vote counts, right? You know, that man's a pirate, you know, and that man's a burglar, and that man's a politician, and your votes are all equal. So get out there and take this incredible coincidence of history, this power that's been dropped in your lap to participate in the forming and steering your very nation. But if Christians take that seriously, wow. I mean, we are... I remember a city in Texas that tried to outlaw R-rated movies. They had one movie theater. This guy was wanting to make more money, so he started bringing in these movies. And so the churches got together and said, we're going to pass a city ordinance. You can't show R-rated movies. Now, we're not saying you can't have a movie theater. We can't say you can't show controversial films. We're just saying we don't want the temptation to our children and our fellow citizens and the degrading of the marriage relationship, blah, blah, blah. And I go, now that was Christian. Really, it was. It was saying we want to maintain a space for our families that is, we can talk about that evil. We just don't want to expose ourselves to it, right? Mm-hmm. And yet that was ruled unconstitutional. Because freedom of speech. It seems like every time Christians try to stand up for their values on a grand scale, they get accused of being Nazis. They all want to rule everyone else's life. When sometimes all they're asking is, we just don't want that in our face, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if we're going to be culturally aware and know the Bible and pray, are we going to have to just agree to be powerless in our own culture to avoid picking a fight on the issue of values? I mean, even spending, government spending can be a value issue. Mm-hmm. And so if we as Christians were to stand up and say no because we're Christians, well, now we've picked a fight with the culture at large, and there's going to be a backlash. And if we either are overruled by the mob or we are overruled by, you know, seven guys in robes, now we've just been rendered that much less powerless because the culture has proven you lose when you do stuff like that. So are we going to just have to agree to forfeit our presence in our own country to get by? Are we just going to have to assume powerlessness?
Now, that's asking about the other meaning of holding the line that I didn't talk about, of holding the line, that's at the societal level. And there, my thinking is we have to kind of be judges of the situation, economists. And that is, is this, economics is one of the factors. It's not the only factor. It could be that you decide, you know, I want to take this on. I'm going to form a political party, and we're going to have such and such a platform, and we're going to get a presidential nominee, and we're just going to go for it. That's not necessarily wrong. I mean, that, and you may know that you're going to fail. Fine. I mean, that. But one consideration is, does it have any chance of having the kind of impact that you want it to have? And my assessment of that would be zero. Mm-hmm. Zero. Absolutely zero. Because it's not just that our society is currently opposed to God. It's headed further in that direction. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's not like there. You can have a cultural situation in which Christianity is not present, has no presence whatsoever, and yet there's a certain amount of, you can detect a certain amount of interest or possible turning there. That's one kind of scenario. But you can have another scenario where it's godless and it's intent on being godless. There's no hint of that kind of turning. And that's my assessment of where we are. There's no hint of that kind of turning. So would it be wrong to start that party? Not necessarily, no. If you're called to do it, there may be good reasons to do that, even though you're doomed to failure. I'm just not inclined to sign up yet. Mm-hmm. And it really comes from my observation of our culture over the last 60 years. There is a trajectory, mm-hmm. and it's not a good one. And I think it's quite pronounced, actually.
I say God has put us here, not somewhere else, at right. this time, not some right. when else.
Right.
And he's given us these responsibilities, obligations, and opportunities.
Right.
And I know you can't say yes to all of them, and you have to be judicious.
Exactly.
You have to be wise.
Right.
But in thinking about Jack's paper, if the trajectory is as bad as you agree it is.
I agree it is.
You agree it is. Then we are, if any sort of activism, any sort of attempt to build our space along godly values, biblicism, is simply going to identify us as targets. We're going to be the, in the shooting gallery, we're going to be the ones that pop up.
Right. Do you think that is not the case?
Well, I used to believe that it was might be possible to muster the numbers where you'd be a little less likely to be picked on because there'd be a political cost to that. But now, you know, I think, what if we become the people who draw a fish in the soil when we're sitting on a park bench in a desperate attempt to announce to someone we're believers, but not so openly and so bold as the gendarme who's patrolling that park looking for us sees it and takes us away from our family or our job. Or our access to our influence in our culture, or opportunity. If only, in the case of, say, George Zimmerman, innocent on all charges, and held now before the public with a target on his back, well, do you really win? The guy may have been better off in solitary. He may have been safer. That's what we could become. And there's a part of me that gets so angry that I'm willing to fight back about that. It is wrong to hurt people because they're doing right. Mm-hmm. And I will, by gosh, do something about that. That's the sensation. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we defend the doing of right?
Yes. I'm not sure that we should defend doing right with guns. I mean, using guns, right? I mean, there are various ways that you can defend doing right. And the question is, what form would that take? And does it take an activist form, whether it's forming a political party or getting a militia or whatever you want to do? And there may be good that would come from that. So I wouldn't, forming that political party and all that sort of thing. But my judgment is That's not where things are going. I don't think that good would come from that. It doesn't seem to me that good would come from that. And I would favor supporting doing good and what is right differently on the individual basis and on the small basis. I share the anger, and that's part of why I told this my recollections about the 60s is because things can be different than they are. We have lost a lot, and that's my experience is that when I was right out of college, I went to study in the Soviet Union and in Europe, and while I was there, I became more patriotic than I've ever been. I just was so thankful for what the environment in which I was able to grow up. In the past few years, things have changed so much. It has reached the point where I'm not really proud to be American at this point. And I feel like something was stolen out from under me. And I think that's what you're talking about. But there are lots of things I could be angry about. But I trust that God knows what he's doing. And that whatever he's doing, that was all part of the story. And I'm willing to accept that. He can take that away in the process of accomplishing a greater good. And
I'm curious about your thoughts on when do we try to promote or applaud consistency in our government versus our actual personal beliefs. My idea is that, and you know, this just kind of came up because of the gay marriage debate, so I was curious about this. It seems to me that while the status purpose of the government is to protect the interests of its citizens, promote their opportunities, and while marriage laws that offered financial benefit to being married and better legal protection for those family units, including any offspring, those were not created with the idea of excluding homosexual couples at the time. Now it seems that it has become that sort of thing where there is now necessarily a class, and you know, it's a loaded word to say class, a class of citizens that is enjoying what the government has stated is part of their constitutional mandate, and a class of citizens who are not offered that as well. And the reason that I'm wondering is because it seems to me a system that it has that division in it, a government system that has a division like that in it, is a broken system. And that's not something that can be reformed. That has to be taken out and replaced. I would almost rather see government be consistent about something, even if I think that is a wrong decision that the government has come to, and hold my beliefs and try to reform that, rather than seeing an inequality or seeing something that I find to be inconsistent. Mm-hmm. Because that seems like something that is, it's not something you can transform at that point, mm-hmm, or have effect with.
I wouldn't place that value on consistency, because to do something consistently wrong is not necessarily good. So consistency, I wouldn't place it at that kind of value. In this debate, the reason that historically, the reason that there were these privileges for marriage was to try to encourage and create a favorable environment for families, a husband and wife to come together and form a unit and to have children and have an environment in which those children can grow up where it's stable, the husband and wife stay together and provide care for those children as they grow up. Not every relationship between human beings requires that kind of support. So it seems to me that homosexual unions, that's a whole different kind of thing. Now, does society want to extend some of those privileges to homosexual unions? That's another issue. And that, then it becomes that question that I was talking about with Bob. From my perspective, you have to make that difficult choice. Do we want to keep those laws in there as a restraining device? Or is it time to let homosexuals marry, that we run the risk of law becoming a laughingstock by holding on to something that society has already raced past? That's a difficult choice. We'll just take this last one, I think.
I'm glad you brought that up. I have a niece and a nephew, both who are gay, and my sister's two children, mm-hmm. and I have a grandson mm-hmm. who's 21 and has come out gay. And I guess our position is just to love them. And if something comes up and they question, just to state our values. But I think accepting them as people, I think that has, I guess, helped us, you know, go through this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, Margaret asked, what would you do if they were going to get married? The daughter did, and we did go. I think they understood our position, but we were just mm-hmm. loving them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's clear that they know how we feel. Yeah.
And that's one of those difficult decisions.
It was a difficult decision.
Do you go to a ceremony like that or do you not? Those are very difficult decisions.
Very difficult. It was tough.
Yeah, our son and his wife decided not to go. Right. So we had that.
Right.
That raised another issue in the
right.
family, surely.
Those are very difficult decisions.
It was. It was. There were two bad decisions and we had to make one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And our son is in the organized church, in the evangelical church. Mm-hmm. So
yep.
thank you mm-hmm. for talking about what your struggle was and how you came to recognize that they're people, they're wicked like we are. It's just a different sin. And yep. and as a marriage and family therapist, I did some research and talked to many gay people, and some knew that they were gay at 5 years of age, mostly males. And sometimes women chose to go that way because of sexual abuse, which was one of my specialties, dealing with people who were molested as children.
Yeah.
So it's just a toughie.
Well.
But just to know.
The revolution of the 60s has left us in a mess. I mean, we really are in the rubble of what they did. And we're going to see that playing out, that there are kids that are really messed up as a result of all that's happened in society and the tumultuous environment in which they're growing up, and it is sad, and I don't know how to address all those problems. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Sure. Father, it is often the case that I think to myself that I was not cut out to be a human being. It is a very difficult process to go through life and to live it with integrity and honesty and taking you seriously and wanting to do what is good and what is right. And the problems come in every shape and form. There is no end to the multitude of situations that we can be presented with that are difficult, where we have to sort out what's right and what's wrong. We are deeply in need of your grace, and I pray that you will shower it down on us and that you'll help us to get the clarity that Ron was speaking about, and to be able to see things through your eyes and to address problems wisely in a way that honors both you and righteousness. Give us the clarity and give us the strength. I ask this all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks.